Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, we are talking about the Android 11 beta. It dropped. It happened. It was a week late, but it's here. And we are also talking about a new phone with a massive camera, both physically and metaphorically speaking. And joining me this week, Andrew Martinick. Welcome back. What's going on?
It is very warm in New York City, and that's the only thing that's at the top of my head.
If you hear the whir of the air conditioner, please forgive you, is what you're saying.
Yeah, might as well be a life support system at this point. I know I'm a total wuss about this, but it'd be warm outside.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you at all. And I guess on the other side of the spectrum in terms of weather, I assume it's always cold where you are, Alex, is Alex Dobie. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's not exactly hot, but it's not exactly cold either. We had an uncharacteristically warm May, but now it's back to the usual gray English weather. So there's that.
So you're back in sunny or in the Queen's old England, sunny old England.
It was sunny old England. Now it's just regular England.
Got it. Okay. And how's the emotional temperature in England these days?
Simmering, I guess. It's a slow bubble.
Yeah, it hasn't burst quite yet.
It hasn't burst just yet. But yeah, it's a strange year. It's taking a toll on all of us. But we're getting along.
Well, so this week I wanted you on because you have been along with me and Andrew playing with the Android 11 beta. It's here. It's a bit more consequential than I guess we initially thought in terms of features, and it's not quite as buggy as I expected it to be, but maybe that's because it had more time to bake.
I think it's extremely buggy.
Oh, good. So we'll have differences of opinion. Yeah. And then, Alex, you have been playing with and reviewed the Huawei P40 Pro Plus, which is a mouthful.
I hate myself every time I say the name of that phone.
But it is like a really big deal in terms of camera optics. It really pushes things forward. So I want to talk about all the cows that you took photos of.
Because a lot of cows, sheep as well.
The sheeps too, yes.
Sheep.
This is a farm friendly episode. No cows or sheep were harmed in the making, I hope. Although they look a bit surprised, but maybe that's just
they do. I mean, I would be surprised as well at the Huawei P40 Pro Plus.
Okay, we'll get there. So, Andrew, last week we spent a lot of time talking about how the beta was delayed and about the social situation, the unrest that led to that delay. But on Tuesday, Google kind of emailed us and gave us a heads up that, you know, no keynote, nothing live, just that they would be dropping everything on Wednesday, a blog post, the beta, and a bunch of videos. It happened. The beta program was launched, and it's pretty easy to sign up. If you have a Pixel phone, you go to android.com/beta, you opt your phone in, and after a few minutes, you should receive a notification.
Pixel 2 and later.
To update. Yes, your original Pixel is staying on Android 10.
Womp.
So now that you know we have this on our phones, let's go through big features, the stuff that's most obviously changed from Android 10, and then some of the more subtle updates that people may want to check out.
Yeah, so the big visual things really go around, well, kind of visual and functional together, is basically a lot of the stuff that touches the home screen. So it's notifications, it's launcher, it's multitasking, and it's media control. So the notifications are kind of an expansion of what happened in Android 10, where Google tried to give you a lot more control over things that alert you versus things that come in silently. And now we have a third tier that kind of goes above alerting, and that's conversations. And so that's where you can break out notifications based on individual threads inside of apps, like WhatsApp or Telegram or Signal or whatever. So I can have a discussion with Alex in Telegram, and I can have just that alert me And it comes in separate from all my other notifications up at the very top. And then if I don't want to, be alerted by a conversation with Daniel instead, no matter what app, I can say, deprioritize that. That's silent.
How dare you?
I know. Sometimes we all need a break, all right? So it gets into this weird thing where you want to have control over your notifications, but giving people this many options is a bit, it can be a bit overwhelming. And especially right now, because we don't really know how it works completely, because applications have to be updated to properly delineate between conversations in the apps. So right now you kind of run into this problem where the settings don't really get applied to just one person. It ends up kind of giving it blanket access to the entire app, but you still get the visual distinction of the conversation separately, which is really nice. And what's tied into that is these chat bubbles, which we keep hearing about over and over again, and were kind of made famous by Facebook Messenger however many years ago, where you can keep these conversations separate from the notification shade. You can actually have them be floating bubbles that you can drag anywhere on the screen, and they kind of stack up so you have all these conversations. The difference is this can be across apps. So you can have a stack of bubbles that has a Facebook Messenger conversation and a WhatsApp conversation and an SMS conversation in it, and it's just tied to that group or that individual. Again, we don't really know how well this works because apps haven't really plugged into it. And that's kind of frustrating.
And I think it's going to be interesting to get a feel for the experience that awaits us when Android 11 eventually launches. No doubt we are going to be in this weird interim period for a while where some stuff is a bubble and some stuff is a regular notification. And if someone contacts you on Messenger or WhatsApp, maybe it comes through as a bubble, but then sometimes on another platform, it might be like WeChat might be a notification. And, you know, how long is it going to take everyone to get on board with bubbles? It's going to be a bit of a mess for a while, like as has been the case with many a new Android feature over the years.
Yeah. And if there's one thing to be said for adoption of new notification channels, at least applications got on board pretty well with the separate notification channels and things like that. And we were worried for a while when Google introduced the idea of priority notifications that can like go past do not disturb and show up on your lock screen and all this kind of stuff. We were worried that messaging apps or, you know, other apps would abuse that. And that hasn't really happened. So apps seem to have kind of kept in their own lane of what they should do in terms of respecting, you know, users' time for the most part in notifications. It just really depends on, you know, like you said, how motivated are they to add like full on new features like the chat bubbles.
So what's interesting about this is in an ideal world, and you mentioned the reality of it, where most apps are perhaps going to treat conversations and bubbles differently. But in an ideal world, you know, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Google Messages, Telegram, Signal, all of them enable these APIs. They act the same way, or at least predictably. You have a situation where you have this in your notification shade, a separate conversations area, and it really doesn't matter what app you're getting a notification from, right? It just all looks the same. It's consistent. You have these quick replies that you can, you know, easily either press one of the pre-populated quick replies, or you can type out a response. And I like that because, yes, you're going to be able to tell through the icon whether somebody's messaging you in Telegram or otherwise, but it's going to be easier to parse multiple chat apps at the same time because they're not going to be all strewn together with your, you know, your news notifications and your battery settings and all that stuff. And it could actually make using Android as a messaging platform considerably nicer. And the other thing that I think is really interesting is that as part of this new API, you can set priorities for particular people. So I use Hangouts, RIP, with my wife right now, And you can actually go in and select an individual person to prioritize. Not only will their chats come to the top of the conversation list, but their face, the avatar that's associated with that person in that app, will be in the notification shade when you get a new notification.
Instead of the Telegram or Hangouts or whatever.
Yeah, and it's like those little touches that actually make messaging people a little bit more pleasurable and a little bit less janky. The way that it has been in previous versions of Android.
It's interesting to look at how this has pretty much pushed the actual app to the background, and instead you're looking at a very people-focused messaging system now, to the point where even the UI of the app that you might be using to send your messages is not in itself that important, because when you tap on that chat bubble, you get a shrunken down version of that, which, in whichever app you might be using, pretty much looks the same.
Something, something, Palm OS, Windows Phone...
But it's not wrong, right? Like, it, for all intents and purposes, unless you are, you know, a end-to-end encryption stan or somebody who really, really cares about, you know, your signal groups or your Telegram, you know, chat groups and things like that, it doesn't really matter what platform you're using. You know, I don't care if you message me on WhatsApp or Hangouts as long as the app notifies me on time and I can easily respond to you.
And really, it just gives you more control over those chat notifications in the same way that you really should already be leveraging Android's notification channels for all of your other apps. You shouldn't just be giving, I mean, just for your own sanity, you shouldn't necessarily be giving every app full notification access. You should be setting a lot of these things to silent or just, you know, to not show up on the lock screen, etc. It can save you a lot of hassle and just annoyance from having all of these apps ping you all the time.
I'm just thinking, like, what about something like Slack, where you're getting DMs, you're also getting channel notifications? How does that work? Or, you know, how do you want that to work in something like Conversations? Like, should the DMs only show up in Conversations and then the channel notifications in the standard?
Yeah, that's tough.
Android?
I mean, you could apply the same argument to anything, like, for example, WhatsApp. You know, how does WhatsApp handle a group chat versus a single person?
Right.
And a group of three versus a group of 20.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that's where notification channels come in. And perhaps for that, you have a separate channel for each. You know, you set a threshold where it goes over that certain number, and then maybe it's a different notification channel and it's deprioritized. It's going to be something that chat app developers are going to have to dig into in the months ahead, I think.
Yeah, Google's good at, like, giving developers tools and saying, here's the best practices, and then letting them go and do their own thing. And that comes with its pluses and minuses, obviously, but it'll probably work itself out, I hope.
So one area where Google's taking away some of the developer control is in the ongoing media notification now, because it's fully integrated into the system and it's part. So when you play YouTube Music or Pocket Cast or whatever, it used to give you that permanent notification, and it was always a little funky because different phones handled an ongoing non-dismissible notification differently. Now it's part of the quick settings. And so when you pull down the notification shade, you get a mini version of it. And then when you expand the quick settings shade, you get a full version of it. And I've actually seen now when you have multiple ongoing media or potential ongoing media, like if you paused a podcast and then played music, you actually get multiple cards that go scroll side to side in the expanded quick settings view. It's a much better way to handle this, because just the notification shade now, especially with the three different delineated areas, is getting really, really long, and it's losing its information density. And it was already the case that on a smaller screen size, if you had a full size rich media notification, it was taking up half of your notification shade. And that's just, you just don't really need that. You need just to play, pause, and seek buttons. You don't need to have it take up all that space. I really like having it up there. And the nice thing is now, because you know it's there, you get a little button that you can tap to then decide where the audio goes in terms of wired headphones, Bluetooth headphones or speaker, and the speakers. Unfortunately, you don't get an option to send that to cast targets, but I could easily see them adding that.
it's interesting to look at, yeah, like, as you said, everything you said about the notification area kind of becoming cluttered and media notifications outgrowing their place there is absolutely true. You could make the argument that it's duplicative to have a separate area where, hey, you have your card stack of notifications, which is a card stack, but then an additional card stack of media controls. And you could say that's a bit confusing in the same way that having the new power controls behind the power button that control power things. And then you have the you have the quick settings, which also controls things that are on or off. In a way, it's a bit duplicative, but at the same time, you know, it's about what you're listening to right now versus what apps are trying to tell you, and that those are two very different things. In the same way that your Wi-Fi settings, things on your phone that are either turned on or turned off, they live in the quick settings. Things that surround your phone that you might want to turn on or off, or, you know, payments kind of fit into the same sphere there, that now lives in this new sort of secondary menu that is this much expanded power menu in Android 11.
Yeah, that expanded power menu is the other part of this. It's just, it seems like Google is finally understanding that you can build frameworks into the core of the operating system that can adjust based on the types of devices and services you have connected to your phone, rather than making everything an app or everything a notification. The new power menu with all of these smart home controls is just a perfect example. Like, just create this area where anything that goes into the Google Home app can now have a quick toggle or you know, a quick launcher, you know, related to your cameras or your whatever smart home, smart lights, all that kind of stuff in there. And it can be different for every single person, not unlike, you know, you can shuffle around the quick settings buttons to whatever order you want those to be.
So here's what kind of frustrates me about this is that I think it's a great idea. I think that, you know, this is basically taking the UI from within the Google Home app, and it is putting it as a front end in the power menu. Great. But is this the right place for it? Should it have been a part of your home screen, perhaps, like enabling the discover feed to the left of the home screen? Could this just be, could that have been the area where this went? I feel like it was one of those things where Google had a conversation about where's the best place to put these controls that people use increasingly often. I think they must have data to show that people are going into the home app. It's become a consolidator of all of your smart home products, especially if, like, you have a bunch of Nest stuff. Google treats them now like first-party experiences, which is great. But I don't know if the power menu is the right place for this. And I just wonder if it was one of those competing, you know, conversations internally where they're like, no, I think this should go here. No, I think this should go here. Okay, let's just compromise and put it here. And that's what they did.
I think the issue there is, I mean, you're right. It's not a very discoverable area in the same way that on a Pixel phone, the Google Discover tab, which, by the way, I still think is garbage. It's just a list of crappy news stories, but that's
except
a different
when
discussion.
Our stories are there.
Crappy news stories and Android Central news stories. I think the issue is, if you're Google and you're building this out at a platform level, and this is a platform level feature, if you look at the there are leaked documents out there that show how this is going to work in terms of CTS, and to pass CTFs, you are going to have this in your power menu in Android 11. You need something that every manufacturer has to have in order for this to be significant at the platform level. And it's hard to do that on the home screen. It's really hard to mandate that. So, you know, you can't really put it in the notification shade because that's already getting cluttered, especially now you have media controls living there. So the power menu is kind of the last slightly logical place that you can move this stuff.
Yeah, really your only other option is the iPhone method where you have a different swipe, you know, from one corner or the other to pull down a different shade, which, you know, we know Android did that on tablets for a while, where you'd swipe down on the left side of the screen, you get quick settings or notifications. You swipe down on the right, you get quick settings. One of the two. Clearly, it worked so well. And I mean, that's the way the iPhone does it. But also, you would be shocked how many people with iPhones I have told and shown for the first time where the control center is on iOS. Because that too is 100% hidden. The question is, you know, you know, how do you get people to press and hold the power button the first time? I mean, after they know it's there, then it's fine. It's just, how do you get them to go there the first time?
Mm. The answer is going to have to be the same thing that Google has tried to do with gestures, right? You have the new swipe, diagonal swipe thing for Google Assistant now. And so it's just going to have to be a case of, you know, gently coaxing the user to say, hey, here's some stuff that lives behind this button. And it, you know, it may become a little overwhelming to people who have to learn, okay, notifications from the top down, apps from the bottom up, and then diagonal for Google Assistant, and then now this new long press. And that's not even including the squeeze gesture that you have on Pixel phones, right?
I mean, there is something to be said for the fact that we already use the power button on just about every other phone with the double press to launch camera. And that's a thing that's become really ubiquitous, and people know, you know, unless you have a Motorola with the wrist twist, that you can double press the power button on most phones and it's going to open the camera. You can at least know, I mean, it's just a changing of thought process to, okay, you're not just using this. I mean, you could argue that this is a much better use of the power button, putting all this useful stuff in there, than just the power off or restart options, because mm-hmm. you don't power off or restart your phone that often.
That's true. I mean, that's another thing too, is that,
I mean, this is what, look at what Samsung's already done with the side key. It's not even a power button anymore.
Right. And by default, it opens Bixby voice if you hold it down too. Like it's not something that is obvious to users. And I actually agree with you that the it's kind of a side effect of the fact that our phones are so stable these days. Most people don't restart their phones. They don't turn them off. I don't remember the last time I did either of those things. And it is, I'm worried that it's going to be buried in there. But it is interesting that if you look at the way Google's designed this, the emergency restart and power buttons make up maybe 10 or 15% of the total area, right? So they are just putting this menu to better use. And I think it's going to come down to re-education and telling people that this is no longer a power menu in the traditional sense. It is just another
hub. Side key.
Yeah, it's a hub that your Google cards, your Google Pay cards, your loyalty cards, and your smart home buttons are there. Oh, and by the way, if you want to restart your phone, you can do that too.
Yeah, and I hate to continue to just be the Apple advocate person because I don't even have an iPhone, but you know, this is how Apple handles Apple Pay too. You can't tap to pay without double press. I think it's double press the power button to launch Apple Pay to be able to, whereas Google, you just have to have the phone unlocked and you can pay with your default card.
I think I'm going to get emails about this, but I think now if you have a card selected as like a default card and you go near
the
payment terminal, it will just show up because the NFC will detect the payment terminal. But correct, if you know this for a fact, if you're an iPhone user, email me.
Well, anyway, that's how Google Pay works, so I do know that. But it's just to your point that the ecosystem, smartphone ecosystem as a whole, has to, you know, make use of the limited hardware keys we have left. You know, we're just down to two or three at this point, depending on the phone. And if you can do different combinations of those to you know, reduce the number of just wacky gestures you have to have, then that's probably a good thing.
And Alex, I mean, you've used phones. I mean, it's still kind of an outlier, and I think it will be for a long time. But you've used phones where there is no power button, right? Like Meizu has released phones that are portless and buttonless. It does. It may not feel like this is the inevitable future, but we are certainly moving to a place where there are going to be fewer explicit buttons on our Android phones. And that's the kind of thing where Google may be, you know, painting itself into a corner by hiding this behind the power menu.
Yeah, and I mean, perhaps in the long term, you're right. The phones that I've used the most that don't have buttons, if you want to look at last year, there was the Mate 30 Pro on the Huawei side, where you had a weird and actually quite cool double tap gesture to control the volume. There was still a physical power button there. But if you want to take it to the extreme, the HTC U12 Plus, which had buttons that weren't there.
We all know how successful that was.
Yeah, I mean, if you imagine a version of that actually worked, you still have the, the physical remnants of the buttons there. It's right. just that you don't have the moving part, which is a point of failure. So it's, you know, it's better because you're not relying on this tiny micro switch that could potentially fail at some point. You're always going to need to have some sort of contact point, some explicit contact point where if your phone is off, you hold here, press here to start it up. Maybe that's not always going to be a button, but you will need to have some sort of physical thing there, whether it's something that you can see or something that you can feel that will let you power your phone on. Who knows how that's going to shake out, but if you have that thing that is easy to find with your hand to power your phone on, then it stands to reason that you should also be able to use that when your phone is powered on to perform various tasks, whether it's a double tap for the camera or whether it's a long press to open up this new menu.
Yeah.
And I also just look at the way that the Pixel 4 reacts to my usage. I don't use the power button to turn on the screen. I only use it to turn off the screen at this point, which is something that LG tried to do for a very long time with Knock Knock and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the Pixel is just awake and ready to go anytime I get near it, pick it up, look at it, and it unlocks as soon as I pick it up or look at it. So you're already getting to the point where it makes more, you know, it makes more sense to use that side key for other things.
Yeah, any phone with that kind of 3D face unlock combined with good raised awake has the same thing. The iPhone has that. The Mate 30 has that. You know, lift it up, immediately the cameras fire up and it unlocks straight away. And yeah, I found myself in the same position. You don't use that as an unlock button. It is just a lock button when you finished using it.
There's definitely... I think if any company is going to do it through mandating this feature, you know, being included in the power menu, it's going to be Google, right? Like nobody else would be able to get away with this. And I mean, the thing that I worried about a little bit is if Google is necessitating that developers put these buttons in the power menu or side menu. What's going to happen when Samsung decides to do something just a little bit different, or they already have that devices menu in the dropdown you can essentially do
where
the
do
same
they put
thing.
Their smart things stuff, and where do they put Samsung Pay?
Yeah, it feels like this is going to start a bit of a war again.
Look, it's already funky with Samsung. Like they have, you enable gestures, and then you can also have a swipe up from the middle of the bottom of the screen also launch Samsung Pay.
And also there's a slightly shorter swipe from a slightly different part of the screen for one-handed mode if you have that enabled. It's kind of a mess.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I hope Google has made this very clear and that we won't have these problems, but we probably will, let's be honest.
So before we talk about the relative bugginess or not bugginess of this, can we talk about one-time permissions really quick? Because this is something that is going to be required for developers and is finally Google really putting its foot down on developers who spam you for access to things.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big deal. Jerry has said it many times that this is one of the best things that Google has done for your privacy on an Android phone. And it's about damn time. The only problem is that it's going to be on Android 11, which is going to take a long time to get any uptake.
I mean, we said the same thing about on-use permissions, and now, you know, that's pretty ubiquitous because we finally made it up there with that. So, I mean, it'll get there eventually. But the big thing is that when you launch an app and it wants a permission, allowing full all-time use of that permission is no longer one of the options. It's you can use that permission once, you can use it while the app is open, or you can use it not at all. And if you want to grant full location or microphone or whatever permission to an app, you have to go deep into that app set or the system settings for that app and provide it. And if the app keeps spamming you to get you to give it permission to something, after a few times of you saying no, the system will block the app from asking you anymore. Which is just awesome, because you know that any developer that actually is respecting their users, like, they're not going to do that anyway. This is just to catch those spammy apps that are trying to take shortcuts or try to gather more data than they need.
And if an app needs to have constant access to your location in the background, it should be obvious to the user why it needs to do that. And then, you know, it should be obvious why they should go through those extra steps.
That's not a gotcha situation.
Yeah.
Is there an ongoing notification when an app has your location in the background? I don't think so.
I'm not sure about that. And I'm not sure if they're going to do the reminders. Like iOS gets really annoying with the number of times that it reminds you that apps have permissions.
Yeah, which is, I think, for location access, probably a good thing.
More information is good.
Everything else, maybe not. But I find it quite amazing how quickly the conversation turned in the last couple of years, right? When it wasn't that long ago that Android only allowed location data to be always available or not at all available, right? It was
and
so,
on install of the app.
Yeah, and the exactly. You had to agree to it at the time of install, and that was it. It wouldn't allow you to pop up later on and check in on you to change it. It just felt very concrete and very permanent. And this granularity, you kind of complain about additional complexity when it's applied to a mobile OS, but this is the kind of complexity and granularity that is required to keep users safe. And I feel like it's pretty intuitive. You know, the fact that you have to go all the way into an app settings to allow all the time is one of those things where it'll just cut down on that abuse almost entirely.
Absolutely. I'm happy about it.
One thing I want to talk about before we move on is this predictive app bar in the Pixel launcher, because it's not necessarily a new idea, right? A lot of third-party launchers have been doing this for a long time, but this is now going to be officially part of the Pixel launcher, and that means that a lot of people are going to use this, because it's not just Pixel launcher. It's going to be Android One devices and, you know, Motorola devices may adopt this at some point. So what do you think about this? Because I found the suggestions to be mostly bad, but I guess it's based on usage patterns. And over time, these suggested apps should get better.
Well, the interesting thing is that I found the suggested apps on Android 10, just at the top of the app drawer, to be relatively good, but your standards for how good they needed to be useful were pretty low, because you were already going to the app drawer to look at all your apps. So if you just put a suggestion at the top, you're like, okay, cool. But now if you're going to give up your dock, I guess is what we would traditionally call it. If you're going to give up your dock, or it's maybe three of your apps in your dock, you want those suggestions to be really good. The problem is that I just opened up speed test on my phone and ran a speed test, and now it's suggested, the suggested app in the dock is speed test. It's like, well, if it's just going to suggest my most recent app, then, well, that's not very useful. If it's, you know, just let me know what it's supposed to be. Is it supposed to be a list of my most recent apps? Okay, like that might be a thing. But if it's supposed to somehow be intelligent, where I wake up in the morning and the bottom of the bottom dock is, you know, all my morning apps, whatever, then like it needs to execute on those.
Yeah, I think the execution isn't there yet, and it is a very valuable piece of home screen real estate, to the point where it's the thing you turn to with probably with muscle memory more than you realize. Probably on every phone you use, you have the same four or five apps down there. It needs to nail it, and to be honest, even if they are all five useful apps, it doesn't necessarily help you if you're used to the muscle memory having, okay, camera's here, Gmail's here, Chrome is here. I think probably for my money, the app drawer is the more sensible place to house that, just because it's already an app that presumably isn't somewhere on your home screen that you can just get to anyway. Single swipe up, and then just, you know, you have five of them up there, easy to hit to find out what you might want to use.
And I mean, remember, this was like the thing that launchers were trying to do 4 years ago when launchers were cool. Third-party launchers were cool. Like, this was the thing. Figuring out predictive app placement on your home screen. And like you said, Alex, muscle memory just takes over. And, you know, it's never going to know what I want as well as I have figured out over the last 10 years using phones with an app, you know, app drawer dock.
But I just wonder if this is meant for people who don't actually take advantage of that screen real estate.
Yeah.
I feel like this would be good in that case, for the top row of icons.
Right, but if you think about, like, I look at my mom's phone where she really has not done anything to her home screen. So it's basically the standard loadout of, you know, it's a Google folder on the left and maybe a couple of apps here and there, but they're strewn over four or five pages because she can't really figure out how to move them. So this might be helpful where, you know, she's constantly going into the app drawer to open that same app over and over again. Oh, and all of a sudden, magically, it just shows up at the bottom of your dock and you're like, oh, I want to open that. That's really smart. So there's part of me that's like, wow, that's really helpful for novices and people who are new to using mobile operating systems. And the other part of it is like, Google is an ad company. Google needs to make money from Android. What is this doing to further Google's goal of making money from Android? Are there in the future going to be any revenue-based tie-ins to this feature or any insidious way that Google is going to push particular experiences on users that at the fore may not seem malicious or malevolent in any way, but you know, maybe there's a little bit of like, oh, so you're not opening Google Maps very often? Why don't I put Maps there more often than any other, you know, mapping solution so that you'll open it and see ads in that app? Like there's something a little bit, I don't know, it makes me nervous.
You're hovering over that PlayStation 5 purchase and suddenly the entire bar is just Stadia icons.
Or it just becomes like a buy button and you just press and that's happening.
I mean, even in the less overtly antitrusty way, how many tens of millions of dollars can they charge HBO to put the HBO icon there more often than any other streaming service?
Right. I mean, that you're right. Like, that would never fly. It's like the EU, if that ever was even hinted at, the EU would sue them for 5 billion euro. But you're right. I mean, this is something that Google will tout as a huge advancement in predictive text and in predictive app behavior, and users love it and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, if the actual process is opaque, and it will continue to be opaque because it's Google, I'm still going to be suspicious of it.
Yeah, there are small little predictive things that I appreciate about the Pixel launcher. You know, having the date and the weather up at the top is nice. Getting your like severe weather notifications that come to you silently just in the notification bar, or tomorrow's weather every night. Like, those are nice little things that are relatively inconsequential, but are really nice. The problem with, you know, you only have so much room on, you know, the grid of icons, classic home screen. So every icon that you're expected to seed to Google there is a large percentage of your experience.
100%.
And even with just one app or two apps there, you're like, wow, I'm reminded even more regularly that Google doesn't know what I want to use.
It comes back to like, every time I want to use Twitter less, the thing that I do to prevent myself from opening the app is not necessarily deleting the app, but moving it from my home screen. Like I just remove it from my home screen, I don't use Twitter as much. And it's just a behavioral, you know, reality of human brain, you know, function. Like I will open something that I see more often than I don't. And I can't imagine Google is unaware of this, because they're a lot smarter than me. And anyway, so that could be something consequential. It could be nothing. We'll see. Let's talk about bugginess before we move on. This is the first beta, but there were 4 developer previews. Alex, you actually have this on 2 different manufacturer phones. You have the Pixel version, and then you have the OnePlus 8 version. There's obviously differences in the feature loadout, but also the stability. What's your take on both of them?
So I haven't really used the Pixel version all that much, you know, as a daily driver in order to say definitively how buggy it is. I will say, from what I have used of it, it's significantly less buggy than the non-Pixel version that I've been using on the OnePlus 8 Pro. That, in addition to just being a little bit janky in the features that are there, like chat bubbles kind of like to just sort of fly all over the place when you try and open them. There are also a number of features that just aren't there in that version yet. So if you're using it on a non-Pixel phone, it's really designed for app developers to get a hold of those APIs, be able to test their apps on a non-Pixel phone, as opposed to, you know, an Android fan who might just want to play with the new features. If that's you, then probably you're going to have a better time with the Pixel. But like I said, I can't really judge too much how stable this is, because I just haven't, you know, fully moved into a phone on Android 11 yet.
Yeah. It's something interesting, though, that OnePlus is the first company of all of the manufacturers to provide Android 11 beta software.
They were the first with stable Android 10 as well.
That's right. Yeah.
And they just have a history of running out their own betas, too. So there is something there.
All right, Andrew, what's your take on the beta? Because I think I'm having a better experience than you in terms of stability, but maybe not.
Here's the problem is I can't really compare it to the dev previews, because I was running the dev previews on a wiped Pixel 3 and everything was totally fine, but I didn't have all of my local data. I wasn't using it every day. I installed this right on top of my Android 10 with the June feature drop patch on my Pixel 4 XL. And it seems sluggish. It's just a little animations and things are a little slow. My biggest problem is that the keyboard is just messing all kinds of stuff up. Like text input is weird. And I assume it has to do with the new APIs for the keyboard to interact better with. It's supposed to help the keyboard interact better with apps. So apps know the state of the keyboard and can change their animations to reflow when the keyboard comes in and changes better. But now it's like I go to type something and the keyboard goes up over the app and the text input box doesn't move with the keyboard. Yeah. And so you can't do text selection and you can't, you can hide and show the keyboard and it just gets all kind of weird. So it's just been a lot of like just visual oddities like that and just some sluggishness that makes it rather annoying.
For people who, you know, maybe have a Pixel 3 or 4 as their daily driver, you're not suggesting they install this over their existing.
Yeah, I really don't think so. It just has, I don't care about, you know, if the chat bubbles don't work, like that's fine. That doesn't get in the way of your usability. Even the conversation notifications as is, they don't work perfectly, but it still has the conversation separate. Like that all works. You can see the features like the predictive apps and stuff like that. But when something like this gets in the way of text input, something you do every single time you pick up your phone, it's not very stable from that perspective. That leads me to say that you shouldn't do it if it's your only phone. But I know a lot of people will anyway. I mean, I'm soldiering through it. It hasn't made me try to, you know, wipe and go back to Android 10.
And Google Pay appears to be not working for some people, but yours is
working for me. Works for me. And well, so I put out a Twitter poll and about, I think 15% of people said it works on their phone, which is even more frustrating. And then like 50% said it doesn't work. Some people said that it worked and then they rebooted and it doesn't work. I've seen the opposite. I'm not sure, because it doesn't work for you, right, Alex?
Yeah, it doesn't work for me. And it's that the weird thing is, if you can download one of the many apps that check for safety nets status, that's Google's basic integrity check to check you haven't messed with your phone. The beta passes that, yet Google Pay, you can go through all the steps, get to your bank authorizing it, and then it will just say, no, your phone is modified or rooted. Kind of strange.
And it seems to be there also is a delineation between if you already had cards added to Google Pay or if you're trying to add them to a new install. That seems to make a difference too.
Yeah, not sure.
I already had my cards added.
I do know Google has, and manufacturers in general, have the ability to kind of cheat their way around safety net to a certain extent. If they have a testing firmware that isn't certified, they can basically say, okay, just sort of hand wave it away and say, right, treat this as if it passes, even if it doesn't. And I'm wondering if this is a recent development that, maybe some other apps can get around that, but, some of the most crucial ones like physical payments in a store, maybe they're no longer excluded from that. Or maybe it's just a regional thing, or maybe it's just a beta and it's buggy. Who knows?
Yeah.
All of the above is my guess. Yeah. We'll see. Beta 2 is expected to launch in early July, according to Google's updated timeline. So And there's going to be four betas. There's a third one in early August. And then it looks like the fourth and final beta may be late August or early September, according to Google's, you know, updated timeline. So we'll see. There will be no shortage of improvements to this before it goes gold. And then it'll be public in mid-September, which is
pretty cool. One thing about the ongoing betas is that as of beta one, Google says that the APIs, all of the hooks for apps to interact with the system, are final as of beta one. So we'll actually see some developers publish apps to Google Play that hook into the latest API levels.
Like
so,
Facebook.
Exactly. So you could have, by the time beta two comes out, you could have better use of conversation channels, notification channels, and bubbles and things like that, through apps updating through the Play Store, because you're actually allowed to publish those now.
And that's significant, because previous years you would get to beta 3, maybe you'd be, you know, a month out from release before you get those final APIs. Usually it's a measure of stability, perhaps not with this release, but it gives Google time to focus on other stuff. And remember, once we get to that fourth beta, pretty much it's the same as what eventually becomes final. So it would seem perhaps that Google, we all speculated that Google might be on a slower release track with everyone working from home and the challenges that present themselves there. But, you know, perhaps we might be on target for the standard, you know, early September drop. Who knows?
Yeah, let's hope. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we will come back and talk about the Huawei P40 Pro Plus. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by SanDisk. You know SanDisk. It's the company that sells a ton of storage options, including microSD cards, SD cards, and USB drives. And this week, I've been using the SanDisk Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive. It has a USB-C port on one side and a USB-A port on the other side, and it is incredibly easy to use. You just plug it into the USB-C port on your phone, and you use the included Memory Zone app, which installs really easily, to take files, videos, music, documents, whatever, photos, video, whatever you need, and you push it down to the USB drive, and then you can store it there forever, or you can move it onto a computer or another phone. Now, why would you need this? Well, there are many reasons. One reason is if you don't really trust the cloud backups services that companies offer, or if you just want a redundant place to store all of your files. The second reason is actually about a company that we're talking about on this podcast, Huawei. Huawei does not have access to my favorite cloud backup service, Google Photos. So what I've been doing when I take a long video or I want to move my photos from my phone is I'll just plug in the SanDisk Ultra Dual Drive Lux, and I will download all of those photos and video, and then I will put them on my laptop, and that will automatically upload them to my cloud storage drive of choice. And it works super well. And honestly, it's been a lifesaver, because I use that phone all the time to take photos, as you will hear in the next segment. So this has been a lovely addition to my life, an addition that I really did not know that I needed. And I want this to be a lovely addition to your life. And you can get one with a 10% off code by going to sandisk.com/ACP. That is sandisk.com/ACP to learn more about SanDisk storage solutions, including the Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive. Okay, Alex, so you have been roaming the English countryside, taking photos of various farm animals in order to determine...
We're not going somewhere with this introduction, I hope.
the efficacy of the Huawei P40 Pro Plus's camera. Tell us about it and why it's so impressive.
Yeah, so this phone is the souped-up version of Huawei's main sort of flagship. The main flagship is the P40 Pro. This is the super expensive turbocharged version of that, and that applies in a few areas. Non-camera stuff, you've got more storage, you've got a very nice ceramic back, you get slightly faster wireless charging. In fact, the wireless charging speed now is 40 watts, which matches the speed of the wired charging. Fastest wireless charging, I think, in any phone. But what you really care about if you buy this phone is the cameras. So they've taken the 5x telephoto zoom of the P40 Pro and swapped it out with a 3x telephoto and a 10x telephoto. So that means you get the, you don't just jump from 1 to 10, you have this intermediary level where it's nice for sort of a mid-level portrait shot or just getting a little bit closer to, like, I don't know, a flower or something that might be in a moderate distance towards you. And then you have the super telephoto, which means if something is a decent distance away, you can still zoom way in and pull out a ton of detail, even though if you were to use the main camera, it might be, you know, quite poorly defined and quite small in that photo. And it just adds a ton of versatility to a smartphone camera. I think most of us, well, actually maybe just Daniel, has used the P30 Pro last year. And you remember how much of a revelation it was to use that 5x zoom. This just brings it to the next level, and you have all the benefit of that mid-level zoom as well. It just means you can get a lot closer, and even if, you know, things start to look a little bit watercolory, a little bit blurry towards the, you know, 30, 40, 50 times zoom, you can still have that that really solid 10 times where you're not doing any digital zoom. It's just a solid picture. There's a ton of stabilization there, which there needs to be. For this to even work, given that it's reflecting light 5x internally in this periscope structure to even work. And I've been thoroughly impressed with it. But of course, being a Huawei phone, there's no Google out of the box. If you want Google stuff on there, you have to work within the confines of the Huawei apps, or you need to mess around with your phone in a way that possibly breaks things. So it's very impressive. I think it's undoubtedly the best phone camera in existence right now, probably will be until next year. But for most people, it's a tough ask to live in, you know, on an Android phone without GMS in 2020.
Yeah. So what's really interesting is I think the conversation around the P40 Pro series has been overshadowed by the Huawei Google or Huawei US government fracas. And, you know, obviously it's not available in the US. It's very, very limited in its availability outside of China. And the caveats that come with the purchasing process is, you know, they just mount up, right?
Astronomical.
So that has sort of overshadowed the conversation around the camera. And obviously, you should not buy a smartphone, especially a smartphone this expensive, for just its camera. But just give us some context as to how much better this is than the Galaxy S20 series or the Pixel 4, or how much more versatile. Because I've tried to convey that in conversations I've had about the P40 series, but I don't know if I've said it as elegantly as you have in your review.
It's like, I mean, this is maybe oversimplifying it. It's like having another lens at your disposal. You know, if you have a physical camera with an interchangeable lens, you know, it's just another tool that you have there, and it gives you greater confidence in photography where you know. You know, we're all used to being out with maybe a single or double camera phone where you know if something's way off in the distance, if you zoom in, it's just going to look like crap. This kind of lets you expand the breadth of what you can actually do with a phone camera. You know, there are some things that you wouldn't even think to take a photo of before, whereas you have this camera now, and actually it's not just an extra level of zoom, but it's an extra level of zoom with stabilization that works with night mode, that is, you know, high quality and just, you know, gives you that extra, you know, that extra freedom, right? You know, we started off single camera phones. Okay, maybe you go to a 2x telephoto. That's an extra tiny bit of freedom. Then you add an ultra wide in. Okay, you have a little bit more freedom there. And this kind of blows the whole thing much wider open, because not only do you have, you know, probably the best sensor in any phone in the main camera, which is, you know, gigantic one of a 1.28-inch 50-megapixel monstrosity. You have the ultra-wide as well. You have the medium telephoto and the super telephoto. It's just a huge amount of freedom in what you can, the kind of photography you can do in something that is still just regular smartphone shape and size that doesn't have anything protruding from it, really, that will fit in your pocket comfortably. And, you know, you don't need to carry around in a bag. You don't need to have bulky extra lenses with you. It's hugely liberating to be able to do that in something that is smartphone sized.
And I said a lot of the same things about the Galaxy S20 Ultra in particular, because that's just the one I used, where I found myself taking a lot of 4X and 5X photos, just because the quality was now good enough at 4 and 5X that it wasn't some big trade-off between, do I want full quality at 1 or, you know, middling quality at 4 to 5. But the crazy thing about the P40 Pro Plus is that it offers you that at 10X. Which is just nuts. Whereas, you know, I think we all talked about when the S20 series came out, 10X is where that camera really starts to fall off, and you accept some of it to get the crazy zoom, but you know you're not getting the full quality.
And we talked about versatility before, and we also talked about farm animals before. And if you want to bring both into the same question, taking, as you know, and kids are the same, I would imagine. If you get a different kind of shot of a kid or a pet, from a distance than you would getting up close in their face with a phone camera. It lets you get a more natural shot. It lets you get a photo without spooking them, you know, or them running off or looking a different direction or getting distracted by something. So it's not just about a better quality photo from further away. It's perhaps about a different kind of photo because you can keep your distance from your subject.
Yeah, I found that last year I took the P30 Pro with me to Turkey for a family vacation. And I found that exact thing, right? Where, you know, my daughter could be hanging out with, you know, her cousin or whatever. And just being able to kind of capture that moment from far away is very, very, it's a huge advantage, right? Mm-hmm. Especially for kids that are shy and don't want a camera in their face. My daughter now, you know, nearly a year later, every time I have a phone in my hand and I'm taking a photo of her, she wants to take a selfie with me. So she won't let me take a photo of her because she wants to see herself on the screen. So that does pose a challenge when I just want to take a candid shot of her. But I do, like, Alex, this may not be great radio, but there's a photo of a bee in your P40 Pro Plus review that it blows me away every time I look at it. And it's a crop shot. It's clearly a zoom shot to some extent, but it's got this beautiful bokeh. It's the bee has a ton of detail. Tell us about the situation that you took this in, because, you know, this is basically an SLR shot.
So what I was trying to do there is I was trying to use the 3x lens. And of course, both the 3x and the 10x have a limit in terms of how close you can be, right? Just because of the optics of the lens. So I actually thought I was using the 3x for that, but of course it knew that I was too close to do that. So it just flipped straight away to a digital crop of the main sensor. And as you could, you know, because it could actually focus, it got a much better shot. And because the sensor is so large, for that main sensor, it can switch to a 3x digital crop and it still looks fantastic.
That is really crazy. I mean,
it's the same size sensor, I think, that was in high-end point and shoots maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It's pretty wild. Yeah.
All right. So obviously we're going to get some pushback because, you know, Huawei, blah, blah, blah. Most people are not going to be able to benefit from this, but talk about the sort of legacy that this is leaving in the smartphone industry, right? Like, this Huawei has been ahead of the game in terms of sensors and optics to some extent for a couple of years now. Starting with the P20 series, I would say. But how long does it take for this type of versatility to trickle down to a Samsung or, you know, even a Google? I mean, Google's going to approach this very differently, obviously. But, you know, I think a lot of people were critical of the fact that the Galaxy S20 Ultra promised a lot and really, really under-delivered in many ways. And I just don't see that being the case here.
So I think there are a couple of things in play here. First is that, you know, remember, even now, as you mentioned, availability of this phone is very limited, and it's also very expensive. So, you know, obviously, I don't know this for a fact, but I would imagine technically it's just very difficult to build that 5x reflecting periscope thing. Perhaps there are issues with the yields there. That's why it's expensive. That's why the supply is lower. You know, I would question whether it's the how easy it would be for Huawei to build this at the scale of, for example, a Galaxy S20 Ultra. At the same time, it's definitely a raising of the bar in terms of what you can do in photography in a phone, especially in telephoto in a phone. So I would say it's probably going to take at least a year for others to catch up to where we are with this. And I think probably some won't even try. And there'll be different approaches that people take to this. Some people will say, as Samsung tried to do this year, okay, why would you bother trying to, you know, engineer your way around all the compromises of multiple periscopes inside a phone when you could do a single periscope and just stick a giant sensor in there? That's another approach. So I think, you know, eventually we'll have perhaps Oppo, perhaps Samsung, perhaps even Apple trying to, you know, recreate this or make their own version of this. So you have this, you know, super telephoto at the high end of your zoom loadout. But I think we'll also have some manufacturers who, you know, try and achieve the same results, perhaps with just through sensors or through AI or through some other means.
I just like that this sets a really good bar for secondary sensors no longer feeling completely secondary.
Yeah.
You know, the quality on these zoom lenses is, and the sensors behind them, is just incredibly good. And the fact that you can still get really great night shots out of those as well is just something that we haven't really had, you know, at our disposal up to this point. You, like I talked about earlier, there was always this trade-off that your secondary cameras, they give you a different focal length, but you give up on quality.
Yeah.
And this is closing that gap even more.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to go back to, say, a Galaxy S9 or something of that era where your telephoto, your 2x telephoto, basically was just a daytime lens. You knew if you took it out after about 6 p.m.,
yeah,
it was going to be a digital crop. And with this, you know, when you're dealing with a 3x and a 10x lens, you can't afford to have it fall back to a digital crop because it's going to look like crap even on a really, really good main sensor. So, yeah, I think whether it's just improved sensor quality or whether it's improved processing, probably a little bit of both in the phone that we're talking about today, you know, it's forced manufacturers to make sure actually you can use the whole range of sensors in a whole range of lighting conditions, which is just as important as, you know, extreme zoom or anything like that.
Yeah, I've noticed that the photos I've taken with the regular P40 Pro have been better just from a processing perspective than the P30 Pro by a pretty significant margin. That Huawei has tried to figure out that, you know, you don't always need to, you know, jack up the contrast in order to make things, you know, stand out, right? You don't need to emphasize the HDR in every single photo taken outdoors. It just, you know, I think they've understood that nothing, you don't have to, you know, dial everything up to 11 just to be a Huawei photo. And that has led to me being very happy with a lot of the photos that I've taken. So yeah, they're finding, like, just fall back on the fact that these are really good components and that's really all you need.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the current state of the app gallery, Alex, what's that like, at least for you in Europe? Because there may be more options than there are here in the US.
Yeah, it's improving, but it's still pretty rough. They have a search engine now on their phone that can help you track down apps from elsewhere on the web. And that's also built in kind of to App Gallery as well, where in search results, you'll see links to download the APK from the app developer's website. That's how they can get around, you know, not being able to do business directly with companies like Facebook for WhatsApp and things like that. It's still rough. This is still the very early stages of like a 3 to 5 year journey for them. One of two possible outcomes, because, you know, they're not going to stop making phones. That's, you know, when you have the resources of Huawei, you just keep going. Outcome one is they reach the end of that 5 year journey and they have their own reasonably successful mini ecosystem, but probably the market share is quite diminished. Outcome two is perhaps with a change of administration in the US next year, The license that they need to do business with Google or Facebook is granted in the same way that the license for Microsoft was granted. It's going to be one of the two. But in the meantime, it's a bit of a messy situation for anyone looking to find apps. And by the way, it's not just the case of finding apps. It's when you find the APKs, will stuff actually work? Because some stuff relies on Google Play services and Google Firebase, which even if you find the app, won't necessarily work on a phone without GMS.
Yeah, that's been my main issue.
And that's the thing. I mean, will we just go back to just earlier in this podcast where we said that the average person doesn't even set up their entire home screen and has, you know, the default folders and configuration on their home screen for a year and a half after taking their phone out of the box. They're probably not going to go through the trouble of searching for an app, downloading an APK from a developer's website, and then bothering to update it and on and on and on. That, like, it's just such a crazy uphill battle to get users.
That's what their Petal search thing is designed to get around. And I believe there's like an updating component built into that as well. They're trying to do everything they can to ease the pain points there, but you know, they are still currently pain points.
Yeah, got it. Well, I think we're going to leave it there. We went a bit longer than normal this week, but it was all in the name of a really good discussion. Thanks, guys. What is what's your plan for the weekend, Alex? You gonna go out and shoot more cows?
I'm currently apartment. Yeah, I'm currently apartment hunting, so that's going to take up a decent chunk of my time.
Wear a mask.
I will wear a mask. Yeah, don't you worry.
Okay, good.
Don't lick any door frames.
well, yeah. Now that you say it, yeah.
Thanks, Dad. What are you doing, Andrew? Any plans?
I am going to go see our good friend, Mr. Mobile, over on his side of the river, which is, you know, that's always a big deal when you cross a river, you go to a different neighborhood. Because I can't get him to come to Central Park, so...
Are you running there, or just taking transit?
In this case, I'm going to bike, because I have a long run planned for Sunday morning, so I can't do back-to-back. Also, the problem is, you know, when you go for a park hang nowadays, you have to have a cooler full of beverages, and so, you know, running with a cooler full of beverages is not good for you or the beverages.
I don't know. Could get them nice and carbonated if you need them.
Yeah, the amount of public drinking happening in Central Park is off the charts, and it's quite amazing.
Yeah, is it happening while social distancing? Because I doubt it.
Groups are keeping their distance just because, you know, you don't want to, you know, even in normal times, you don't want to be sitting right next to somebody in the park. But the blanket circles are definitely getting larger and larger with the number of people, and just lots of passing around bottles of wine and things, which is, you know... People got to have something.
Yeah, you got to have something to look forward to.
There's literally nothing else to do in Manhattan right now.
Well, so. The number of cases in Manhattan or New York in general seems to be going down a lot. So that's
yeah,
that's
Manhattan in particular, which is great for me.
Well, I hope both of you have a great weekend. And if you listening have any feedback for us, send it to podcast at Android Central. We love hearing from you. I want to acknowledge the couple people who emailed me saying we were talking about the Android TV dongle yesterday or last week, and how, you know, people love having a remote. And mm-hmm. A couple parents emailed me and be like, I hate remotes because that means that it lets kids touch the remotes, which means that they constantly change what we're watching or turn on the TV when we don't want them to. So we've ended up having to hide the remotes for things, even when there are, you know, even when the boxes that they buy have them. And mm-hmm. I, as somebody who's got a toddler who loves playing with TV remotes, I totally acknowledge and understand that feeling. So
I get that.
Thank you for your feedback. That's that was really funny. All right, that's it. We are going to be back next week with another show. And until then, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
See you later.
So long.